on Mother's Day. Moms give praises in the day off on Father's Day. The men mow the grass the day before. And I thought, well, that's what you get, the curse of the garden. So, but actually, as I sought the Lord, really, I'm drawn back to Judges. I'm drawn back to Judges. And actually, there's a mom in there. I'm assuming this lady's a mom. And you'll see this when we get on with the message. So begin making your way to the book of Judges. I will let you know up front. I've preached from a single passage. I've preached from three verses and taken up about 45 minutes. And with that in mind, it ought to scare you that we're going to be doing somewhere around 57 verses this morning. The reason we're not having Mother's Day services tonight is because that's about what time I'm going to get done. Actually, it's going to be perhaps a relatively shorter sermon. I've actually added less to it. Conscientiously and subconscientiously, whatever you want to call it, unconscientiously. Certainly some of my meditation on this was in my unconscious time. I was meditating on the Word as I went to sleep and as I woke up, so you could call it unconscious meditating on the Word, or subconsciously. We will spend most of the time in Judges chapter 9 this morning. And again, without necessarily apologizing, the bulk of the message this morning is going to simply be reading through the passage without as much deep dive and as much commentary, simply because of the length of the passage. But, you know, when you go into the start of this passage, you really have to have the end of this passage. Otherwise, you're going to walk away just feeling it just won't be complete. This is one of those where you've got to get the whole picture at one time. You're going to see some stuff you are absolutely not going to like. And there's an explanation for it. So let's find out why we're where we're at. Judges 21:25, that favorite verse. In those days, there was no king in Israel, except for this morning's message. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And last week, I think we clearly made the point that the problem isn't that there wasn't a king. The problem is that everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes. And we see from Genesis, both in Genesis 6 and in Genesis 8, that the heart of man is desperately wicked. And from Jeremiah, that it's desperately wicked. So we find ourselves this morning with an actual presentation of a king in the book of Judges. I mean, didn't we just read that there was no king in Israel? And yet we're going to see a king this morning? How's that going to happen? Because sometimes individuals will self-proclaim. They will proclaim themselves king. And they won't be appointed as king. And that's the case this morning. An individual, through vile means, elevates himself to the position of kingship in the nation of Israel. Now, what's so bad about anyone doing what's right in their own eyes? Scripture tells us there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is death. We're in the book of Judges. It covers that 350-year period from 1400 to about 1050 B.C., and it captures the downward spiraling circle of sin, suffering, supplication, and salvation. And for just about everybody in here this morning, that should be pretty much a repeat or a review of where we've been. Last week, Gideon had this great answer towards the end of Judges chapter 8. He had this incredible, miraculous salvation of the nation of Israel. He himself and 300 other people went and stood at the edge of the camp and demolished 120,000 people, actually witnessed the Lord destroying 120,000 hardened soldiers, and then they pursued another 15,000 and put them to rest as well. So based on that, the men of Israel wanted Gideon to be the king. And Gideon's answer in Judges 8, and back up a couple verses, the men of Israel came to Gideon and said, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of the Midianites. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Well, that certainly may have been Gideon's heart, but that wasn't the heart of one of Gideon's sons. One of Gideon's sons through a concubine. You know, once again, we see in the Scriptures the practice of polygamy. Never do you see it lead to anything good. It always leads to something destructive. Always something with jealousy. Always something with infighting. And this one peaks at those characteristics. That was Gideon's answer. But we saw that Gideon accumulated multiple wives. Deuteronomy said that when you go into the land and when I appoint a king, don't build up wealth, don't build up soldiers and armies, and certainly don't build up multiple wives. Gideon did that even though he wasn't a king, and his son is going to do worse. Then there was Gideon's action. Gideon's action. Verse 29. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, I'm in 8:29, went and dwelt in his own house. And Gideon had 70 sons who bore his own offspring, for who were his own offspring, For he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. Remember what Abimelech meant? Abimelech means, my father is king. And it could have been a personal title with reference to God, but based on Gideon's actions, it's not quite so clear. And you know, sometimes we can profess one thing, and another time, our actions speak a little differently. That's called hypocrisy. The church is full of them. I know that. That's what most people have trouble with. They say, oh, your church is so full of hypocrites, and you just lovingly put your arm around their shoulder and say, we always have room for one more. See if that gets you bonus points with them. Now, Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age, and he was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Now, here's where they start that downward spiral and that downward cycle again. And this portion is necessary to understand what's going on in Judges 9. So it was, in verse 33, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals, and made Baal-Berith their god. There's a fascinating tie into that name. That Baal-Berith is kind of like the title, we're entering into a covenant with Baal, is essentially what that name means. And it's just not the, it's not just that the name is bent out of shape and that we're entering into a covenant with Baal, it's where they're entering that covenant with Baal. We'll see that in a minute as well. As soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel played again the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-Berith their god. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, which is Gideon. Keep in mind, those two names can be used interchangeably, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. In fact, Gideon himself, embedded in his own name, shows you that there is a conflict between the God that they're going to serve and the man who had just rescued them from oppression for serving that God. Jerubbaal means he contended with God, contended with the Baals, or the Baal gods contended with him. It's as if the gods were whining about this man who was destroying their temple, and that's how Gideon got that name. But once Gideon is gone, once he stepped off into glory and in the presence of Christ, those who remained went back in and played the harlot. The children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Now, you know that if they're not going to remember the God that Gideon served, they're not going to remember kindly Gideon either. And it tells us, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. The key here is that the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God. The key here is that there's no king in Israel. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And I ask you again, is the problem in Israel that there's no king, or is it the heart of the people who are doing what is right in their own eyes? You see, Proverbs again tells us that there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is death. Now, I want to stop you for a moment, because quite often when we read that passage, we content ourselves to say, okay, there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is death. That man's going to go do his own thing. He's going to do what's wrong. He's going to die for it. Well, that's certainly true. But what do you do with a man who steps out of the will of God and takes people with him? What about guys who are doing what's right in their own eyes? They drink and they jump in a car and they drive and they kill somebody else with them. You see, the impact of individuals doing what's right in their own eyes is not only limited to the person who deserves to die. Quite often it includes multiple people around them. This is certainly the case this morning. And so the end is death. Now in Judges 9, we follow the life of Abimelech. He is the son of the valiant warrior Gideon. He is the son of a godly man who stumbled even just a little bit. But he's the son of a man that God used mightily. And you know that means absolutely nothing to the next generation in many cases. Now, before we dive into this, several doctrinal statements are in order. We have to cover something that's very doctrinal so that we can properly comprehend what's beginning to happen in Judges 9. There are several timeless truths that we need to make sure we grasp before we begin. And they're going to seem so elementary to you, and yet they are so necessary to properly view in the Old Testament. The first one is this. There is none righteous. No, not one. How many innocent people are in the room this morning? In and of themselves. None. There is none righteous. No, not one. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. How many people in this room have sinned? Fallen short of the glory of God. Everybody. The wages of sin is death. How many people in this room deserve to die as a result of their sin? Pretty simplistic, pretty elementary, isn't it? Now, what happens, well, I remember listening to a pastor, one of the three most influential men in my life, Mark Lauterbach. Because in this book, a lot of people die. In fact, in this book, as in this room, everyone dies. I mean, do we really stop and think that everybody in this room is going to die? It's going to happen. Everyone in here is going to die except those who may be taken in the rapture. And I say that's an exception. I'm not convinced that our spirits are taken and our bodies are left at the rapture, so that it's going to have the appearance that we died. But in the words of Mark Lauterbach, my pastor, one of our former pastors, and one of three most influential men in my life, he says, only once has an innocent man died. And he's right. But someone might say, if Christ is innocent, then he did not bear my guilt. And you know, he is right. But someone would argue, they can't both be right. And I would say, you know, he is also right. I don't know how many of you love Fiddler on the Roof. That's the closest I will get to Retsevia. You know, he is also right. Christ died innocent. He was the only innocent man to die. But he wasn't innocent in his death because he was carrying my sin. We'll leave it simplistically like that. But we also think that the wages of sin is death at the very end of a very long life. Yes, the wages of sin is death, and when I'm 90, I'm going to face that. But an individual apart from Jesus Christ is deserving of death at the moment they conscientiously sin against God. There is no trial period. There is no appeal process. There is no trip to the Supreme Court. There's no 20-year wait on death row. There does not have to be. For the wages of sin is death. And at that very moment, God could completely carry out Romans 6:23 and be completely justified in that person's death. God in His holiness would be completely righteous to take the life of an individual at any moment. And I put this next portion in bold, and I filled it with red. An individual, apart from the Savior's payment for their sin, meaning a non-believer, continuously walks with the ever-present reality that God, at any moment, may require their life for their sin. The non-believer, person who has not had that saving relationship with Christ, can at any moment have their life righteously taken from them. The wages of sin does not mean death at 90. The wages of sin means God is justified to take the life immediately. That's the righteousness of God. We need to see that. Because in Judges, a lot of people die, but none of them are innocent. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And we walk away from this not seeing the atrocity here, but seeing the grace of God that lets non-believers live, even having sinned against them. God is long-suffering. He's not slack, but is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to relationship. Now we find ourselves in Judges chapter 9. And you're thinking, wow, that's just the intro. Now we get to start the 57 verses. Might not be as short as I thought. The atrocity, Judges chapter 9, verses 1 through 6. Did Abimelech, and I'll try to be repetitive on these names because there's a lot of names to follow here. So Abimelech is Gideon's son. Abimelech is Gideon's son. Then Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem. That's that city that's important. To his mother's brothers. Okay, so he's going to his mom's side of the family. Not his dad's side of the family. He's going to his mom's side of the family. Happy Mother's Day. To his mother's brothers, and spoke with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal, keep in mind, he's using that term in mocking because they have now begun to worship that Baal. Is it better that the 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bone. And his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem, and their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. You see what happens with concubines? They have split relationships. There are 70 sons of Gideon. And then there's a son through a concubine. Now, a concubine would have been left to live with her parents. And so you've got a boy who probably raised up without seeing much of his dad and certainly wasn't treated as an equal son. And so now in his own personal ambition, he's going to do contrary to what Gideon said. What did Gideon say? I shall not rule over you, nor shall any of my sons. The problem with that is sometimes our children don't always follow what our passion for Christ is all about and our passion for the Lord. You see, they're not going to get it from us. They have to get it by being born again of the Spirit of God. That's where they will get their passion, and Abimelech does not have it. Verse 4, so they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith. They've taken the money from a false god, and with it Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men. And they followed him. They went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left. Gideon had one son other than Abimelech who gets away. His name's Jotham. Because he hid himself. Verse 6, and all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. Now, if you know the history of that city, Shechem, you understand where that city has now gone to and how that city has so degraded. Do you remember the city of Shechem in history? Do you remember the city of Shechem in Abraham's life? Turn with me to Genesis chapter 12. Hold your place in Gideon, or in Judges. We were there so long, I renamed the book. Genesis chapter 12. You should remember this as we went through the series on Abraham, a friend of God. In verse 1 of Genesis chapter 6, we remember, or Genesis chapter 12, the Lord said to Abraham, hey, get out of your country, go to a place. And in verse 6, Abraham passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh. And the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And he built an altar to the Lord where? In Shechem. By what? The terebinth trees. And it only takes a couple of hundred years later, and Abimelech is at that same location where there's a tower, there's a pillar to a false god. And on a stone, instead of building a sanctuary where he's going to worship the true and living God, he's going to offer up 70 of his brothers as a sacrifice. Joshua 24. You can turn there. You'll recognize this verse. It's been a popular one in the church for many years. Prior to going into the land, verse 1 of Joshua 24, Abraham, 400 years of bondage, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then 400 years of bondage, they come out of Egypt. They stumble in the wilderness for 40 years, and they're ready to go into the promised land under Joshua. Joshua chapter 24. Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God at Shechem. Verse 15. Actually, we can back up to 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord, Joshua says, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And so Gideon's house did while Gideon was alive. Joshua made that plea at Shechem. Back to the book of Judges, chapter 9. Verse 5, he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons. And he did so on one stone. Now, folks, it took us about a minute to read that verse. It took us about a minute to read that verse to understand what happened. But I promise you, it took a lot longer to carry this out. This is not a 3 to 5 minute, let's go in and slaughter the sons of Gideon. Gideon's sons were individually and consecutively brought to one place, to one stone, the one stone, and they were executed. It's possible that many of the brothers watched as their brothers were killed until it came time for their turn. One son executing 70 of his brothers. Now, we understand that this occurred rather frequently. We perhaps can understand even the logic, as demented as it is. He's a half-son, if you will. And the only way he could lay claim to any throne that would have come through Gideon, which Gideon didn't have, is if he killed all his brothers off. What's amazing, go back into the text. There's no king in Israel, and everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. So you've got this man that's just executed 70 people. 70 sons of the hero who rescued you. And what do? They went and made Abimelech king. Where? Where Abraham had built an altar. They made him king where Joshua said, "For me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." And they've anointed a king. Does God call him a king? Nope. He's not even referred to as a judge. But we've got a man who's raising up, and this time the sin of Israel and the oppression of Israel comes from the same point. It's not an external source this time. The problem is within the nation of Israel, and it's going to bust out in civil war. That was the place, folks, where God was worshipped. Shechem. That's the place where God used to be king. Do you know it's the same phrase that can be spoken of every church that has closed its doors? That used to be the place where God was king. May it never be said of this place. Kathy and I had the privilege of going, and I've shared this story with you, to a chapel on Stanford University campus. An incredible, incredible chapel. It is huge. Probably sits 1,000 to 1,200 people. No sound system, no amplification, not needed. Granite walls, granite floors, whatever the stones are, you can be heard speaking at a normal tone, normal volume from up in the front of that sanctuary, in that chapel. Not quite as loud as the cell phone. But you can be heard in this chapel. Not a single amplification system anywhere in there. Not necessary. They had a spiral staircase that came up to a pulpit up in the air. Incredible. Stained ornate glass throughout. Inscription, perhaps even in gold on the wall. Scripture after scripture after scripture. And you go to the center of a place that almost was in the shape of a cross because it had a long regular sanctuary. It had two vestibules on the side. And then it had the stage area. And looking down, it may have looked like a cross. Looking up, it had an oval roof. 12 tribes of Israel. 12 apostles ordaining the walls. Behind there was the images of the birth, the death, and the resurrection of Christ. Incredible! And as you walked up to the outside of this chapel, it says, "Built for the glory of God." The only problem is they never hold Sunday services there anymore. There are no services in that place except for weddings. If you've got $20,000 and you're a graduate of Stanford, you can have your wedding there. But the Word of God ceased to be proclaimed. Why? Because God used to be king there. So Jotham confronts him. That's the atrocity. That's the longest portion of the message. the atrocity. Now we reach the parable. Judges chapter 9, verses 7 through 15. And when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and cried out. This is the same location where Joshua read the law to the people. And they said, the Lord we will follow. His word we will do. And when they told Jotham, he went and stood on the top of Mount Gerizim. Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Rationalize and reason with me, because God's listening to who's right here. The trees once went forth. Those of you who've been in John's class on Sunday nights, this is one of the first examples of personification in the book, in the Scriptures, where the author is going to use a parable, where the speaker uses a parable, uses personification to bring the trees to life to teach a point. Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over themselves, and they said to the olive trees, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, should I cease giving my oil with which they honor God and men and go to sway over the trees? Then the trees said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit to go and sway over the trees? And the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine which cures both God and men and go to sway over trees? Probably could preach an entire sermon on those three. Because the olive tree wants to honor God. The vine wants to feed God's people. And the fig wants to feed God's people, and the vine wants to bring joy and cheer to God and God's people. They were too busy serving and honoring God to be distracted with personal and or lofty goals. Their focus was in honoring God, feeding God's people, and bringing joy to God and God's people. End of the sermon within the sermon. Then the tree said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. Keeping in mind that the honorable has turned down this position. The dishonorable and the worthless has accepted it. And that's the example Jotham is giving us in his parable. But if you will not come and take shelter in my shade, and worse, if you will not anoint me as king over you, then fire will come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon, Jotham says. He is prophetically speaking here. While the first three vegetations serve as a beneficial purpose to men of God, the bramble had only one application of usefulness. The bramble was a bush that was used as kindle to start fires. It was a dry, thin, prickly bush that would quickly light, flash bright and hot, and would just as quickly burn out into ashes. Sounds like a description of someone calling themselves Christians. It was feared by farmers because it would quickly spread fires across the field. You know, out in West Texas, you can open up your vehicle and go really, really fast and still be outrun by tumbleweed. That's bramble. It's a worthless bush. The Bible Knowledge Commentary summarizes the parable this way. The major point of Jotham's parable was that only worthless people seek to lord it over others. For worthy individuals, listen, are too busy in useful tasks to seek such places of authority. As the final conditional statement to be their king, the bramble requires them to take shelter in the shade of the bramble bush or face devouring. You know, this is both ironic and prophetic. It's ironic because the bramble doesn't cast a shade. It's a twig. It's a bundle of twigs. There's no shade to take cover in. And it's prophetic because it describes how Abimelech will destroy those who oppose him. Listen, he's been vicious to his brothers. He's going to get worse. Watch as civil war breaks out. Because nonetheless, the people make Abimelech the bramble king. The bramble king. Let's look at that prophecy in Judges chapter 9, 16 through 21. Now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal in his house, here's what he's saying. If you have acted in truth and sincerity in making this man king, and if you have dealt well with Gideon in his house and have done him as he deserves, for my father fought for you with his life and he delivered you out of the hand of Midian. But if you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed his 70 sons on one stone and made Abimelech the son of his female servant king over the men of Shechem because he is your brother, if then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, listen to this. Let fire come from Abimelech. What is bramble good for? Kindling quick flash fires. Let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. Let them unleash on each other. And Jotham used the greatest form of martial arts known to mankind. He ran away and fled. Run fool. And he went to Beer. That's not to go get a beer. That's another location. Multiple places called Beer. And dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. He's not heard of again. But that prophetic statement is incredible. Let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. Let there be civil war. And not just civil war. A civil war with fire. Well, the question I kept asking, where is God? Where is God when 70 men of a valiant warrior are killed? And I tried to say innocent men. And God says, no, there's none righteous, no, not one. For the wages of sin is death. Wow. After Abimelech, in verse 22, after Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, where's God? God sends a spirit of ill will. That's a nice soft term for a spirit that's going to generate civil war. God sends a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dwelt treacherously with Abimelech. Why? Why did God send a spirit of ill will? Here it is in verse 24. That the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might be settled, and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who aided him in the killing of his brothers. God is about to open up and bring justice. And what instrument is God going to use? Is he going to raise up a judge? Nope. He's going to take a spirit of evil, he's going to take evil men, and he's going to turn them loose on each other. Going to give them free reign. Because a man will do what's right in his own eyes. Verse 25, the men of Shechem sent men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains. And they robbed all who passed by them along the way. And it was told Abimelech. What's happening is, as folks are trying to bring in all the goods, the people of Shechem are now ambushing them. So that Abimelech is not receiving the income of all this famous trade routes. New name for you here. Now Gaal. G-A-A-L. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it properly or not. The son of Ebed came with his brothers and went over to Shechem. This is a new guy on the scene. This is a true Canaanite. This is a guy who's a full-blood Shechemite who is straight from the Lord. He's not a half-breed like Abimelech. And the men of Shechem put their confidence in him and Gaal. So they went out into the fields and gathered grapes from the vineyards and trod them and made merry. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank. Here they are in the midst of false worship, is what they're doing. And they cursed Abimelech. But the Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech? And who is Shechem that we should serve him? Mike, we call that liquid strength, don't we? Individuals under the influence of alcohol get strong in their own minds. Now Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Probably with a little bit of slurred speech. Is he not the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zabiel his officer? New name. Gaal, another bad guy coming on the scene with his brothers. Zabiel, one of Abimelech's kingly officers. is not Zebulun's officers, serve the men of Hamor. These were the guys who owned the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him if not his people were under my authority? If only his people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech. Bold speech, considering Abimelech's nowhere around. So he said to Abimelech, who's not around, increase your army and come on out. Bring it on. Bring it once, because you're going to be there all day. You and your army, bring them on. Well, let's just briefly look at this. God sent the spirit of ill will. God in his righteousness and authority would not raise a judge in this case, but would use the forces of evil as beckoning to accomplish his will. In 2 Corinthians 12:7, we say the same thing. Paul said, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Listen, folks. God controls all things. Satan has to ask for permission before he can touch Job and his family. And when God chooses to, he commands the evil spirits to do what he wants them to do. Why? Because he's an omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent God. He's God. He's sovereign. He's in charge. Demon, yes, sir. Go do what I tell you to do. Yes, sir. That's a demon. Being commanded by God. Ah, but we're not done yet. That's the mighty. Abimelech is mighty in his own eyes. Bring out your army. Gael. Gael saying, Abimelech, bring out your army. Bring it on. This next verse, next section, I call the mouthy. You'll have to excuse me. Judges 9, 30-38. When Zebul, who is Zebul? He's an officer of Abimelech, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gael, his anger was aroused, and he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly saying, take note, Gael and his brothers have come to Shechem, and here they are fortifying the city against you. Now, I had highlighted portions of this verse with the intention of leaving it out, but I'm not going to. Because it's the word that's living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. Far be it from me to think it's appropriate to leave out a portion of this passage, so we're going to continue reading through here and pick up. Verse 32. Now therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you. This is Zebul giving suggestions to Abimelech. And lie in wait in the field. And it shall be as soon as the sun is up in the early morning, that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may then do to them as you find opportunity. So Abimelech and all the people who were with him rode by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. You see what's happening? They marched throughout the night. Zerubbabel sent somebody, and they marched throughout the night, and they are sitting outside of the Shechem walls. When Gael the son of Ebed went out and stood in the entrance to the city gate, Abimelech and the people were coming with him. They rose and from lying in wait. And when Gael saw the people, he said to them, look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains. Not quite as bold when he's hung over. But Zebul said to him, nah, you're just seeing the shadows of the mountains as if they were men. What's Zebul doing? Convincing him that what he's seeing, he's not really seeing. And when you're hung over from a drunken stupor, you believe those things. So Gaal spoke and said, no, see, the people are coming down from the center of the land. And another company is coming from a diminished terebinth tree. Then Zebul said to them, where indeed is your mouth now? Where is the big guy? We had a friend who used to say that people had a dump truck mouth and a wheelbarrow butt. All talk, no ability to back it up. Where indeed is your mouth now, big guy? Booyah! With which he said, who is that Abimelech that we should serve him? Are these not the people whom you despise? You wanted it. Go out, if you will, and fight with them now. You were talking smack. Go fight. Go fight. The murder. Judges chapter 9, 39-49. So Gael went out. First mistake. Leading the men of Shechem, and he fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him. And many fell wounded to the very entrance of the gates of Shechem. Then Abimelech dwelt in a room, and Zebul, this is his commander, drove out Gael and his brothers so that they would not dwell in Shechem. You see what's happening? Gael thought he'd go hide in the city, and Zerubbabel said, no, 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 you get in the fight. No, 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 you get back in the fight. Forced him out to fight. And it came about on the next day that the people went out into that field and they told Abimelech. What happened here, and it's hard to understand, is these guys are dead. The bad guys are dead. So they're thinking, all right, they killed the bad guys, we can go back to work. No blood, no foul. We're just going to go back to work. They killed the guys that were causing the problem. We weren't causing any problems. We're just normal people from Shechem. So let's go back out into the fields and work. But Abimelech came out of the city and he rose against them and he attacked them. Verse 44, then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city. And the other two companies rushed up upon all who were in the field and killed them. For the wages of sin is death. There's a way that seems right to its man, but its end is death. Not always to just that person. Husbands, you can be responsible for the death of your family. Verse 45, so Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he took the city, and he killed the people who were in it, he demolished the city, and he sowed it with salt. Archaeologists have uncovered these ruins. And they see this city and the ruins of this city seeded with salt. And it's intended to keep anything from growing. Archaeologists have uncovered this. Now when all the men of the Tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Berith. Listen, God is a strong tower. Berith tower, And they told Abimelech that all the men of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together. Then Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand. Watch this. Remember what the bramble's good for. He took an axe in his hand and he cut down a bow from the trees. And he took it and he laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people, just like his father did, what you have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done. So each of the men likewise cut down his bow and they followed Abimelech. They put him against the stronghold. They surrounded this tower with these trees and they set the stronghold on fire above them. So that all the people of the Tower of Shechem died. About 1,000 men and women. Whatever you have seen me do, make haste and do as I do. That was the command Gideon gave in Judges 6:17 to righteous warriors. What you see me do, do. Here's an unrighteous son. Do what I do. And 1,000 men and women die. For the wages of sin is death. But remember the prophecy? Do you remember what Jotham said? Let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem. The remaining son of Gideon pronounced a curse. And the curse is coming to roost. Here's the vanity. And I think it's the humor, actually. Verses 50 through 55. And we are close to being done. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he camped against Thebes and took it, another city. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women and all the people of that city fled there. And they shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower. Wow, where have we seen this before? So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it. And he drew near the door of the tower to do what? To burn it with fire. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Happy Mother's Day. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and he said to him, draw your sword and kill me, lest any man say of me, a woman killed him. So his young man thrust him through and he died. And when the men of Israel, you realize that's the first time they've been called men of Israel? They were the men of Shechem up to that point. Now that the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed every man to his place. Now, stop with me. Let's think about this Mother's Day thing and this lady. How many of you moms spanked your kids with bare hands? Don't raise your hands. How many of you moms used a spoon, wooden or plastic? How many of you moms used a shoe? Sanka. You thought Shamgar was good with an ox goad. You ain't seen the mom with a shoe until you saw Kathy's mom. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Your mom was more accurate with a shoe than King David was with a sling and a stone. Dads hunt deer with their rifles. Moms hunt their dear children with their shoes. And you think that if there's three of you, she's only got two pairs of shoes, but she's so good with that first shot, it bounces off the first two kids. hits them both. Well, imagine this mother's poor kids. This lady who's gone up to the top, what did she grab? Yeah, can you hear her talking to her kid? Don't make me get the millstone. Anthony Jr., go get my millstone. You're in big trouble. Listen, this points out a couple of things that I think are ironic. Some woman carried a millstone up to the top of the tower. I'm fleeing from the enemy. Ooh, look at the millstone. Some people carry concealed handguns. She carried a concealed millstone. How do you conceal an 18-inch cylinder that's about 4 inches in diameter? That's if it's the upper millstone. That's the one that rolls over, right? You're using it to crush grain. This woman's heading up to the tower thinking, oh, this might come in handy. I'm going to go, but I'm going to go fighting. Whew! She could carry it. I mean, she was a real woman. And we have uncovered a previously unknown form of martial arts. Millstone Fu. She played rock, paper, and swords and won. Abimelech, unlike Sisera, remember Sisera? Jael nailed his head to the ground. He knew that a woman had struck him. How? Third point, Abimelech most likely saw her drop the rock since he knew he was hit by a woman, right? Let's stop and think about that for a minute. I'm an engineer, and we had to do objects in motion, free-falling objects, and you could take a quick formula. You can take the square root of the height, divide that by 4, and that's how long in seconds it's going to take for an object to fall. Now, if this tower is 6 or 7 stories, it's 64 feet. And the reason I'm using 64 feet is the square root of 64 is 8. Okay. And you take 8, you divide 8 by 2, and you or by 4, and you get what? 2 seconds. This guy was not quick on his reflexes. 1,001, 1,000 crunch. Right? Now, I've got another theory. He most likely saw her drop the rock since he knew he was hit by a woman and for some reason was able to get out of there. Or, he got hit, looked up, and saw this certain woman celebrating like a rookie receiver in the end zone for the first time. Booyah! Do you see the irony? Abimelech, who killed 70 of his brothers on one stone, was himself killed by one stone. Yeah, for all practical purposes, he was going to die from that drop rock. And the head that attained a crown by death at a stone had that crown replaced with a stone. I'm going to execute everybody on a stone to get the crown. And the crown got replaced by God and by this woman with a stone. Now, he called for his own execution, because he doesn't want to die by the hand of a woman. And what we see today still ridicules him 3,000 years later. Because he not only got hit, then he ordered his own execution. Wait a minute. The man who called for the execution of Gideon's sons ended up calling for his own execution. I have called for the death of 70 sons. And by the hand of God and some woman carrying a millstone, I'm having to call for my own execution. Justice has been served. And it was a cold dish. But there's something even more fascinating in this man. Listen to what he says. Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, a woman killed him. So his young man thrust him through and he died. Matthew Henry says this. Here was no care about his precious soul. No concern what would become of that. No prayer to God for his mercy. The man was dying, but his pride was alive and well. Folks will enter eternity in hell the same way. And the same is true of every person without Christ. They have appointed themselves king, even if they themselves are the only subjects in their kingdom. And they're more concerned about their vanity than they are their own salvation. Willingly, they skip their eternity
to avoid humility. It's easier to die and go to hell than it is to walk an aisle to be saved. But there's one other thing to catch from this, folks. Gideon was a godly man. Don't miss the fact that the son of the man that God used in a mighty way, i.e. Gideon's son, was cursed by God. What's that say for second generations? You better be saved. Because you're not getting into heaven riding the little red wagon that your mom dragged you in when you were a kid. You will get there by standing before the living God, and you don't want to hear these words, "Depart from me, I never knew you." Judges chapter 9, two verses to close. Thus, God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers. And all the evil of the men of Shechem, God returned on their own heads. And on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal.